Committee, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2717. And Janet, give us a summary of what we're doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2717 was passed out of this committee on a unanimous vote on March 30th. We did not have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. We discussed after the meeting whether it should have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And you have the fiscal impact statement, and you've had that at the previous meeting as well. And so after the discussion, it was determined that it does not need to go to the Ways and Means Committee. There was a discussion with the fiscal staff and a discussion with the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee. The expense is temporary to fulfill a backlog, and the agency, the Workers' Comp Board, will discuss the effect of this temporary increase when their budget is before the Ways and Means Committee. So, Mr. Chair, Maureen Bach is here from the Workers' Compensation Board. This is a bill that postponed, that required a postponed workers' comp hearing to be held not later than 120 days from its original hearing date, unless the postponement was for certain purposes. The bill does allow for a waiver of that note, of some of the provisions in an expedited case. And it also increases the required notice period for a hearing from 10 to 60 days, but provides that that notice limit may be waived by agreement of both parties and the board. So, Mr. Chair, there wasn't any controversy. This bill has been through the Management Labor Advisory Committee. The question was referral to Ways and Means, and that's been resolved also. So this bill, if it's your desire, can go straight to the floor and repass out of this committee. If there's any questions for any of the parties, several of them are here.
Any questions? Everybody thoroughly understand what we're doing. No, and we've adopted the dash fours already, so we just need to move. Yeah, and so we just need a motion to move it to the floor. Representative Schaffer.
Mr. Chair, I move we move House Bill 2717 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffer moves House Bill 2717 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie would call the roll.
Representative
Esposito. He's excused.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kidd. Excuse.
Representative Schaffer.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier?
I heard Senator Holvey's looking for something to do.
Representing Holvey, would you like to carry the bill on the floor for us?
Yeah, it looks simple enough for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Always looking out for your fellow dude.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3273. Janet, give us a rundown on the bill.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3273, and you should have the dash one amendments in your were in your packet yesterday. The bill prohibits a person whose license is revoked by the Department of Consumer and Business Services from reapplying for a license for at least a year after the revocation. It allows the director to adopt rules regarding license revocations and reinstatements and specifies that a license obtained through error or fraud may be revoked. It imposes a civil penalty for acts that are grounds for revocation of a medical gas system installation specialty registration as well. That's a separate provision of the bill. In the Dash 1 amendments, the changes are that it allows the department or an appropriate advisory board to disqualify a person from obtaining or renewing a license for specified reasons, including if a person has civil penalties or licenses on their license or other sanctions. It also specifies that the disqualification applies to persons who served in various capacities with another business when that business was sanctioned. the period of disqualification, instead of being a standard, will be set by administrative rule under the amendments. And it repeals, the amendments repeal the medical gas installation provisions on January 2nd, 2008. Mr. Chair, that the proposer of the bill can explain the amendments and the purpose behind them and the problems with current law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Jared Brockwood, please? Morning, Jared.
Good morning.
How come we need this bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot here representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Real simple explanation of why we need this bill. Currently, at the Building Codes Division, if I was a plumbing contractor and was an egregious violator and had my license revoked by the plumbing board, I could go back in the next day, reapply, and get my license again. There is no statutory provision that prohibits a person from going back in and reapplying for their license, even though they just had it revoked. The same goes for if you have your license revoked, going out forming a new contracting company under a different name, putting someone as your front man, and then going in and reapplying for your contractor's license even though you're running it. So that is the intent of this bill. It's obviously you get your driver's license revoked, you can't go back in and reapply the next day. Same goes with your hunting and fishing licenses. So we have actually had a case where we had an electrical contractor do this who was an egregious violator and came back in, I believe it was the very next day or within a week's period, and reapplied for his license, and there was really nothing the Building Codes Division could do. So the bill, that's what the bill's aimed at, the Dash 1 amendments, which we do support. We worked technically with the Building Codes Division to make sure those were correct. We like to refer to as piercing the corporate veil. So, like I stated, an individual who would have their contractor's license revoked would go back out, change the name of their corporation or their contracting company, and come back in and try to reapply under a different or assumed name. So, that's the real quick explanation of it. We haven't heard any opposition to this yet, but you can always be surprised at a hearing. So, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the bill.
Thank you, Darren. Any questions? Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jared, can you just briefly tell me what it appears we're repealing the medical gas installation provisions? Can you describe that to me just briefly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I defer to Mark Long of Building Codes. That was, I believe, something that we did in the amendments.
Mark?
I think it's more of a technical change. It's nothing that's...
I just hadn't heard about it. I just thought I'd ask.
Sure.
Or if I did, I don't remember. Take the fifth.
How about a plane?
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long with Building Codes Division. I'm caught a little off guard, so I'm going to give you my best guess here. But if I recall the statute currently... medical gas installations back in about 99 came under the purview of a plumbing license. In 2001, I'm going off of memory here, Mr. Chair, but in 2001, there was a special provision put in the statute that would have allowed non-plumbers to get that medical gas license, and that provision repeals currently in 2006, if I remember correctly. And I think this aligns with that, but that's the best of my recollection. I would need to double check. Representative Holy, does that help?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
We're not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the repeal of the MedGas, that specific section wasn't a policy change or a want on behalf of the plumbers. It was just in working with Mark's technical staff at the division, they thought that would be something that we could do to align that statute up to make it clearer. So,
any other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Gilman got a question.
Administrator. My amendments say 3272.
As do mine.
Mine are right, 3273. Yeah.
And they should be 73, shouldn't
right.
they?
Right. Mine yeah. say 72 as well.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, we got the wrong set of amendments.
Oh, these are the wrong amendments then?
They are the wrong amendments.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So we will take... Maybe, Mr. Chair, we should hold this back and maybe show this.
Yeah, Katie is going to get them copied.
That's got some, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have enough time.
We have some to make copies.
Yeah. Katie will make some off of it then.
Sorry. All right. Thank you for noticing.
That's why I asked, because I couldn't find any reference. I couldn't make the medical gas thing fit into this amendment.
I know, I couldn't find it in the bill.
Can we just carry this over and we'll get it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, thank you for confusing me completely. I really appreciate that.
Have you got the right amendment?
I think, yeah, well, now we do. Yeah.
Well, you're the only one.
Okay, is there any other questions? If not, thank you guys for testifying. I think we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3273, and when Katie gets back with the amendments, we'll start over again.
Mr. Chairman, I think that was my fault, not Katie's fault.
We forgot. Yeah. All was forgiven. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3016, and Janet, give us a summary of that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3016 was introduced at the request of the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Under current law, local governments may adopt fees for administration and enforcement of building specialty codes. The statute gives a group of 10 or more persons, or an association of 10 or more persons, 30 days to appeal the local fees to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The statute also sets out criteria by which DCBS determines the necessity and reasonableness of the local fees, including other, and they're supposed to look at other jurisdiction fees and other jurisdiction calculation methods and the level of comparability of service. House Bill 3016 would require the municipality to provide notice of a new or increased fee and extend to 60 days the time period for an association or a group to appeal the decision, or excuse me, to appeal the fee to DCBS. It provides that if notice is not filed with DCBS in that time period, an association or group has up to a year to appeal the fee. It adds another criteria also for the DCBS to consider in determining the necessity and reasonableness of the fee, and that's the whether they've complied with public comment and budget process requirements. So those are the changes in 3016. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Jared Bronfer again, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot with the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. On House Bill 3016, I'm happy to announce there are no amendments to this bill, which is a rarity, it seems, when we work with building codes and try to get all of our technical thoughts put into concepts as bills. Something that always comes out wrong, but this one was the exception to the rule. What the House Bill 3016 does is just clarify statute. Currently, yeah, there's in statute, there's no provision to deal with if a local jurisdiction doesn't notify at all the building codes division. So if they don't notify, if they completely disregard statute as far as notification, there can be no appeal. If they somewhat notify, then there could be an appeal. So we're just trying to line that up. We've worked with the local jurisdictions to discuss this issue with them, and they've expressed no opposition to this. We're just trying to line up the fee adoption process from local jurisdictions and the Building Codes Division is really all this bill is intended to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. We're not saying go out there and raise fees, though, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, absolutely not. What this does is just so we can have proper notification.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Jared. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3016? Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association, and I just wanted to indicate that the building officials are supportive of this. It's obviously this flaw right now in the way the administrative rules and the statute reads, and clearly if a jurisdiction hasn't complied with the notification requirements, there ought to be the ability to, you know, require them to start all over. So we're in support, and I just wanted to let you know that we have worked with the sponsor to try and help address this issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mel. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 3016? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3016 and open a work session on House Bill 3016. Representative Gilman.
I move 3016 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves House Bill 3016 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Polkin. Aye.
Representative Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Crawford. Aye.
Representative
Teal.
Aye.
Representative
Alcoba. Aye.
Chair Bruce. Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar?
Yeah.
Representative Gilman moves that House Bill 3016 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's done. Two down. Let's see, do we have the amendments now?
Mr. Chair, of all mornings, the copier in the hall is down, so we've sent someone to make copies. So
3273 is still out in space.
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules and allow Representative Kitts to vote for House Bill 271 and Representative Escobel to vote for House Bill 2717, please.
Representative Schaffer moves the rules be suspended to allow Representative Escobel and Representative Kitts to vote on House Bill 2717. Is there any objections? Seeing none. Representative Escobel, how do you vote on House Bill 2717?
Aye.
Representative Escobel votes aye. Representative Kitts, how do you vote on?
I vote aye also.
Representative Kitts votes aye. I should have opened the work session. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I was the carrier last time. Did you want me to?
Who is now?
Holby. Okay.
Oh, I'll gladly give it back to
you. No. I'm just crossing out Escobel and putting in Holby.
Damn.
Let's see. Where are we at now? 33. 04. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3304. Janet, another summary, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On House Bill 3304, you should have the -1 and the -2 amendments, and make sure they're to the right bill. Thank you. I'll start with the -2 amendments. They replace the bill and allow a city to apply to DCBS building codes for approval of application forms, procedures, and criteria for plan review, as well as permits and inspection methods. For setting the fees for a city's special alternative permit and inspection program. This would allow a city in the Tri-County area that is covered by standardized rules and processes to bring a special program or special process to DCBS for approval without having to affect all the other jurisdictions in the Tri-County area. And that's the purpose of the bill and the -2 amendments. The -1 amendment does not conflict with the -2 amendments. They could be adopted together or separately. It adds to the bill that the current requirement for mandatory review of complex structures be limited to jurisdictions that offer plan review services. I think that's a technical amendment. Again, Mr. Chair, this applies to the Tri-County area, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, and the existing standardization program up there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Jared Broadfoot and Greg Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot, I'm going to change hats now, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I don't want to get ahead of Mark Landauer from the City of Portland. This is his bill, and we thank them very much for allowing us to have our Dash 1 amendment to it. Last session, the legislature passed and the governor signed Senate Bill 711, which required plan review only for complex structures. An unintended consequence of that bill was that local jurisdictions that were not providing plan review services before that, under that bill, were then required to provide plan review. We got into rulemaking during the interim and went, a shall should have been a may, or, you know, it was just a small technical fix. So all this amendment does is amends current law to clarify that the folks who were not providing plan review services before aren't going to be required to provide them now. So that's what the Dash 1 amendments would do. We support the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments as well as the Dash 2s and passage of the bill to the floor. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Jared? Don't see any.
Good morning. Members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller, and I'm here representing the Associated General Contractors in support of House Bill 3304. We see this bill as a customer service issue for us. The bill adds certainty to my members' process. I've realized in the last 2 years that one of the main things for my members is certainty in the work that they're doing in their industry. They see a lot of things in black and white, and we feel that this bill adds some certainty to the programs, the pilot programs that the City of Portland currently has in place. So we are in support of this bill. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Let's see. Could I have Mark Landau and Hank McDonald, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3304 today. I've asked Hank McDonald with the Development Services Department for the City of Portland and our city building official to explain to you why we've asked for this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hank McDonald, and I am currently the building official for the City of Portland Bureau of Development Services, and it is my honor to be here today to speak to you on behalf of House Bill 3304. In 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 512, which mandated that all programs in the Tri-County area, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, be the same. While this generates consistency, it also has the unintended side effect of stifling program innovation and flexibility. The result is that the building programs of the Tri-County area cannot be responsive to customer needs through program innovation, something that building departments in other areas of the state have greater capacity to do. The inability to be responsive can slow permitting times and can result in lost business opportunities for the region and for the state of Oregon. The intent of House Bill 3304 is to allow jurisdictions within the Tri-County area the ability to provide the same type of permanent innovation that is currently available to other jurisdictions around the state of Oregon. It would provide the Tri-County customers with a set of program options that are in addition to the standard and required minimum program established by the Tri-County. The proposed alternate programs must be submitted to the Department of Consumer and Business Services for approval before they can possibly become a pilot or a permanent program. After DCBS approval, the alternate programs would be offered to applicable customers as an option to the standard permitting process. This is somewhat analogous to IRS giving their customers the opportunity to file a 1040 or a 1040EZ. So some folks would be eligible to file this new abbreviated form and accomplish the same thing as if they filed a 1040. What House Bill 3304 attempts to do is make sure that the 1040 EZ exists tomorrow. Jurisdictions should be allowed to custom design optional programs that meet customer needs. Specific needs of the customers of Boardman would not be the same as, for example, customers in Salem, Tillamook, or Portland, or vice versa. For example, City of Portland currently offers a pilot program to address the special needs of developers creating large, multifaceted projects. This is our major projects group. One of the dimensions of our major projects group is that we begin the plan review process from the very concept of the project at the schematic point. So by the time we've spent the 2 years creating a set of construction documents, our plan review is virtually done. And basically what this does is this eliminates the past practice of having a 2 to 3 year design come to our office, get put on a table, and we're expected to perform a plan review in, say, 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks. It's not reasonable, and it doesn't happen. So with this new major projects program, by the time the 98% plans are dropped on our tabletop, our plan review is, in fact, completed. Now, this is a special program that we offer in the City of Portland as a result of the diversity of our projects and the size of some of our projects. This may not be a reasonable program to be offered, for example, in, say, Hermiston, Oregon, or in South Beach, or somewhere of that sort. There are two amendments to this bill. The Dash 2 amendment makes it clear that the standard program has been developed as a result of the 99 legislation and has to be continued to be offered. In other words, there are going to be customers that are going to use the everyday, ordinary permitting process, and that suits them fine, and they're not going to be compelled to use any alternate program. The alternate programs are voluntary only. The Dash 1 amendment allows a waiver for plan review of simple plumbing and electrical systems. Industry partners from electrical have already spoken to this amendment, and they're exactly correct in that we see this as potentially requiring jurisdictions who have not heretofore required plan review to then have to require plan review on complex projects, and we feel that's onerous and unfair to the jurisdictions that have decided that they'll perform all of their services in the field. I'd be happy to accept any questions at this time.
Any questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. It really encouraged the enhancing the process of getting permits to get people on the job quicker. But in your discussion, I haven't heard anything about inspection programs, and you haven't mentioned that yet. It's a major part of the, or it is part of this bill. Or do you have alternate inspection programs that you're also dealing with? And I'm wondering how those work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, we do have some programs that are addressing inspection, and the critical dimension that we're looking for in the inspection program innovation is that we provide inspections rather than by a host of different inspectors throughout the course of a project, by one inspector throughout the course of a project. We do not change the nature of our inspections. We do not change the number of our inspections. Code application will look largely the same. The only difference is the added dimension of consistency that we would offer through having one single inspector perform inspections throughout a program, throughout a project.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, one other question about inspection programs, the alternate programs you're speaking of. The alternate programs would apply to all contractors evenly, or is one contractor going to be in a different inspection program as opposed to another?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, our alternate programs are voluntary. Now, the inspections, regardless of whether it's the basic program or an alternate program, are precisely the same. We would require foundation inspections, we require cover inspections, insulation inspections, and so on. The only difference that we possibly are offering through our alternate programs is direct contact with one inspector that would service the project from start to finish. Our basic program we apply to projects is involved through our districting process, and so we have a district inspector that services projects in a particular portion of the City of Portland, and district inspectors, as a result of workloads, will get shifted around. So if you call for inspection any given day, you may or may not get your district inspector. We do have an alternate program that no matter when you call for inspection, you will get the same inspector each time you call for inspection. That's a dimension of that particular program.
One last question. Thank you. So just from hearing what you're saying, everybody is going to go through the same inspections given the type of work that they're doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, absolutely. That is a basic requirement of state statute, and we will continue to do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Could I have Bill Cross?
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here representing the Oregon Building Officials Association, the Building Owners and Managers Association, a group of commercial building owners. And if Mr. Barenberg isn't here at the moment, the League of Oregon Cities. He has legislative day today, so he wanted me to put him on his organization on record in support of the amendments to 3304, both sets of amendments. And BOMA, the commercial building owners, are supportive of this. They participate in a couple of programs that with the city of Portland, for example, that if they weren't enacted prior to the Tri-County service program.
Oh, sorry.
Want me to begin again? They don't.
Ferris.
Anyway, there's some benefits to obviously allowing jurisdictions to do pilots, and if those are successful, to become permanent programs. BOMA is very concerned about fees as well, there's always the option, as the sponsors indicated, that if they don't want to participate in a new volunteer program, there's always the Tri-County the service-wide center program that they can use. So we're very supportive and would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Stephen Kapora, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've heard from the cities and you've heard from the consumers. I'd like to speak, if I may, this morning on behalf of the contractor. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. And I also wanted to say, oftentimes we hear a lot of complaints from contractors about local governments and the difficulties with getting permits and difficulties when getting inspections and the timelines for construction. We want to say that the city of Portland in the last couple of years has gone through a new program of talking to the industry and changing its processes. There's been a lot of reforms, and we are extraordinarily appreciative. We think we're getting things done faster and better and more cheaply, both for ourselves and our consumers in the city of Portland now. We are strongly supportive of this new bill, which we expect will bring more innovations to the contracting process.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Stephen. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3304? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3304 and open a work session on House Bill 3304. Representative Escobel.
Yeah, first of all, Mr. Chair, I would like to ask the City of Portland to give me the information on their Fast Track program and their project groups where they have a single contact. I think that's something that we need to carry to other entities and municipalities, because there's no sense in other people reinventing the wheel if it's a good pilot program. So I would request that if you could get that to me.
And they're nodding their head.
They're going, yeah. Mr. Chair, I move that we move 3304 to the... Let's see.
Got a couple of amendments.
Two amendments.
Oh, we have amendments one and two, I believe. And I request that we put amendments 1 and 2 to 3304 and include them.
We do it in one motion?
Yes. Bill.
Yes. Okay. Representative Escobel moves the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3304. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion? Janet?
We did check with council, and they said it was okay to combine the amendments, that they are combinable. So.
Oh, so they're
you can do it.
Dash 1 and 2, huh?
Right.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they are adopted. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move 3304 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3304 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Holtby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Excuse.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative
Gilley.
Aye.
Chair
Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar or need a carrier?
Oh, I volunteer Representative Schaffler.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler will carry House Bill 3304 on the floor for us. Thank you.
Pretty good. You got out of
all right.
Mr. Chair.
Were we in the work session?
Mr. Chair, anything
yes,
to help the beautiful city of Portland?
Were we? Okay. I'm going to back up to an open a work session on House Bill 3273. And Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have, if you should have the 3273-1 amendments now. And the section of the bill, section 4, dealing with the medical gas system, especially, again, it doesn't relate to the major part of the bill, but that special provision in section 4 is repealed by the amendments, but the agency and Jared do have an explanation for that because the program does sunset. So.
Is there... Hi, Jared.
Mr. Chair, for the record, again, Jared Broadfoot with the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. And Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, to answer your question, I went down and spoke with Chuck Taylor and Legislative Council. Because of the renumbering that the amendments do, Section 4 in the current bill actually becomes Section 5, and the amendments would then repeal Section 5 on January 2nd of 2008. The reason for that is the new Section 5 of the bill, current Section 4, is enforcement language for MedGas. That license actually goes away July 1, 2006. Correct. Is that correct? And so there would no longer be a need for that enforcement language in statute. So that's the reason that Legislative Council put that in there.
Questions?
Now I remember. Thank you.
No questions, huh? Okay, the entertain a motion then.
I'll move this.
Representative Esquivel.
Move that we dash one. Do the dash one amendment to 3273 and apply it accordingly.
Esquivel moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3273. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They are adopted. Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move that 3273, as amended, be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3273 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Kitts. Excuse.
Representative
Schaffer. Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Mr. Chair. Aye. Motion carries. Carrier?
I'll do it.
Representative Gilman will carry the bill on the floor for us. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3356. And Janet, give us a rundown on the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a bill was sponsored by Representative Butler, and we've made a call to him. He's in an adjoining hearing room, so he should be coming shortly. The original bill would require participation in OLCC's responsible vendor program for all new retail licensees and for retail licensees that have been convicted of or had civil penalties imposed on them for sales to minors. The 1999 legislature directed OLCC to establish the responsible vendor program, And that program includes a list of positive measures that retail participants take to avoid sales of alcoholic beverages to minors. The RVP is currently, the program is currently voluntary on the part of retailers. So again, the original bill would make it required for all new licensees and for licensees that have had problems in the past. You have at the Dash 1 amendments, and they were proposed by the Grocers Association, but it's my understanding that they the Dash 1 amendments would have doubled the penalty for persons who were not in the responsible vendor program and had a penalty for sale to minors. But they have proposed a different, raising the penalties, but not doubling the penalties now. So that is the concept that will move forward. We don't have those amendments drafted. They were discussed, just started being discussed yesterday, is my understanding. So they can talk about their current proposal. The Dash 2 amendments are from Representative Brown. We just received them this morning, so you should have those at your place this morning, and I'll let Representative Butler explain what those do when he arrives.
That was Dash 2?
Those were the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Let's see, we have Representative Johnson. I'd like to have him explain that. First, I'm going to do that. Can I have John Steubenwald, please, first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. John Steubenwald, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chair and members, the genesis of the original bill may be old-fashioned here, but I'll talk about the original bill just real quickly. The genesis of that was in an effort to get more alcohol sales training into the marketplace, really as simple as that. The vehicle that was chosen was training that's called for under an existing OLCC program known as the Responsible Vendor Program. Under the Responsible Vendor Program, liquor license holders can voluntarily join the program. They agree to provide quarterly training to their employees who sell or serve alcohol and do some other things, post some signage, some other things called for under the program. In exchange, participants who are responsible vendors would not be sanctioned as heavily should one of their employees make a mistake and sell alcohol to a minor. So it's a pretty simple program. This is a program instituted by the Legislative Assembly in 1999. So what we've attempted to do in the original bill is to say, if you're a new liquor license business after the effective date of this act, or if your business sells alcohol to a minor, then you need to provide the training that's called for under the Responsible Vendor Program. Now, the Dash 2 amendments are in that keeping. But what the Dash 2 amendments do is to remove that provision for new businesses. So the Dash 2 amendments say only if your business is criminally or administratively sanctioned for selling alcohol to a minor, then you provide the training under the responsible vendor as called for by rule under the responsible vendor program. And after 1 year, assuming you don't have any other problems at your business, after 1 year, then you can apply for status as a responsible vendor. So in effect, there's a 1 year probationary period for folks that are not in the program.
I'm not sure if I can craft the question. Just run through it again, John.
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I apologize. I probably layered on a bit. Just one more layer there. Right now, if a business is in the responsible vendor, let me talk about the Dash 2 amendment. Okay, the Dash 2 amendment. Right now, if a business is a member of the responsible vendor program, in effect, the Dash 2 amendment would have no effect on that business. Right? If a business is not currently a member of the responsible vendor program, and that business or one of its employees sells or serves alcohol to a minor, is criminally or administratively sanctioned for that offense, then that business must provide the training called for under the program, and but for the first year, the business must provide the training but does not achieve responsible vendor status. In other words, that business does not get the benefits of the responsible vendor program until after the first year.
Okay. Any other questions, John? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Could I have Representative Hansen, please? Good morning, sir.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'm Gary Hansen, State Representative from House District 44, and my only reason for being here is to oppose the, I believe it's the Dash 1 amendments from the Grocers Association that would exempt members of the Responsible Vendor Program from being part of an alcohol impact area. These are two completely different programs. Alcohol impact areas are designed for as a tool for neighborhoods to fight and combat public street drinking, who are primarily adults. Most juveniles that are involved in alcohol consumption don't do it in a public place or on the street or in the front yard of a neighbor across the street from the stores. Consequently, a program that is geared towards keeping alcohol out of the hands of minors has absolutely no impact on street drinking. One of the communities that I represent, St. John's, has been battling this issue of street drinking for 4 or 5 years now. It's a real problem. It brings down property values. When you get a collection of people that are publicly drinking, they can have a huge impact on public safety in terms of people are afraid to walk on their own sidewalks. They're afraid to confront them. This battle has been going on for, like I say, for years now. What the community did was get very aggressive in terms of trying to combat this problem. They protested some liquor licenses because they felt that the stores were selling to street drinkers. Failed from the standpoint after dealing with OLCC for over a year and a half, that it was felt that there wasn't substantive proof that linked the street drinking with one particular store, that it was more of a common problem within the neighborhood. So now the neighborhood is working to try and get an alcohol impact zone in the community of St. John's. This is past the city council. It's in the hands of OLCC to approve it now. But if some of the vendors are exempt because they're part of the responsible vendor program, it defeats the whole purpose. Basically, what this impact area would do would just restrict the sales of certain types of alcoholic beverages, the high impact, high alcohol content, the types that tend to attract street drinkers. It would level the playing field between all of the vendors, so they couldn't sell single cans. It's a minor step towards solving a real tough problem. But if you exempt some of the vendors because they have a good program to avoid sales to minors, you just destroy the whole impact of the impact alcohol area, which, like I say, one of my communities, has worked for over 4 years to try and get in place. And that's the rest of the bill, I'm sure, is fine.
So, Representative, you support the Dash 2s then? It's the Dash 1s that you're in opposition to.
Okay, it's the ones that... that the grocers have came forward saying, okay,
yeah.
Commission may not impose the restrictions of an alcohol impact area on the holder as required by commission rule. That's the the troubling language.
Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Representative. Just clarify this for me. If we have a responsible vendor who's in this program and they're doing a good job, that makes them exempt. What's the connection with them to the people that are out on the street drinking? If this vendor's being responsible, and I've lived in the middle of Portland myself, so I know exactly what you're talking about. How is that responsible vendor, who's proven track record and they are responsible, connected to the people out on the street that aren't responsible? How's that? Where's that connection there?
Okay. It's legal to sell to an adult.
Uh-huh.
It's probably very difficult to tell whether somebody is going to take the alcohol that they bought and whether they're going to consume it at home in private or in a responsible manner, or whether they're going to take it to the street. So you can't. It's difficult to have that type of a nexus. But in an alcohol impact area, you can restrict. For the whole area, the whole geographic area, you can restrict sales of certain types of alcohol, high alcohol content, individual cans. That doesn't reflect on each whether somebody's responsible or not in terms of whether they do an incredibly good job of keeping alcohol out of the hands of minors.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what the responsible vendor program is all geared toward, is going to be irrelevant to whether or not a lot of people are buying single cans of high impact malt liquor.
Mr. Chair, just so I get this straight,
yeah.
Thank you. So this amendment, the dash one, would allow in those alcohol impact areas that the local government has created.
Mm-hmm.
They would allow them to sell the single cans, Night Train, and stuff like that. And right now they can't. Is that correct?
Well, the OLCC hasn't created the impact area in St. John's yet. The city of Portland has requested it on behalf of the neighborhood, but it's not in place yet. We hope to get it in place soon, though.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative. Could I have Steve Lanning and Jeff Anderson? Representative Butler's here. I'll ask the good representative to come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. My name is Tom Butler. I represent House District 60. My testimony today will be pretty much limited to the fact that you've got a very, very excellent program that you're discussing today in the Responsible Vendor Program. The genesis of the Responsible Vendor Program goes back a number of sessions when we realized that we needed to get our arms better around the overall vending of alcoholic beverages, particularly in places where the folks that shouldn't be getting access to alcoholic beverages were getting access to them. Consequently, we came up with a program, the Responsible Vendor Program, that basically said, let's go ahead and reward those who are responsible vendors with an opportunity to, if they do have violations in fresh, first of all, they agree to do a number of things to come into the RVP, and I'm sorry, I don't know what all of the testimony has been to this particular point, but they have to jump a fairly high bar in order to get themselves into the Responsible Vendor Program, and then they must agree to continue to have continuing professional education for their employees. This whole concept of having trained staff and to be sensitive to community issues, including the alcohol impact areas and those kinds of things, are all part of what were contemplated in the original Responsible Vendor Program, to try and take into consideration that we would have trained employees. And incidentally, the sanctions, really what happened, I guess, as a freshman when I saw that a person could work 30 years developing a small business and having a successful small business, working there 24/7, and then decided he'd take his wife and go on vacation for a week and then come back and find out that due to two or three successive violations while he and his family were out of town, he'd lost his ability to be a Package C beer and wine distributor. And so we changed the sanctions such that those that wanted to be in a responsible vendor program would have printed notices and do other kinds of proactive things. They would also train their employees, and the sanctions would be first imposed in the form of additional training required for the employees, working through the community colleges and other training institutions to provide work skills for the people that work for you, the people that are going to be carding people and the people that are going to be selling these alcoholic beverages. And secondly, then, having those skills be very portable, but then making certain that we didn't take away licenses for minor infractions that we imposed, first in the form of education, second in the form of additional technology, card reader technology and other technology that would show on the cash register that the person had to be born before this date as they were receiving their cash receipt slip and so forth, and other card technology that was being developed and has been developed through our own DMV. So the issue of the alcohol impact areas is a new and burgeoning issue, and I wanted to let you know that this is not to be an issue that is to be the RVP versus the City of Portland. I believe that we can pattern the kinds of exemptions and the kinds of issues within the Responsible Vendor Program, which will address the concerns of the folks that want to set up alcohol impact areas, and that this can be done successfully within the Responsible Vendor Program. I support the discussion of including the industry at the table, bringing the folks from the grocers and from the industry to the table with the OLCC representatives so that we can hammer these issues out. But I believe that it is certainly within the venue of becoming a responsible vendor that we should be able to control the kinds of activity that our retail clerks are involved in and our other distribution folks in the bars and other areas that would be impacted in this regard. I would encourage you to work with the grocers. They've brought some amendments forward, and I understand that originally they talked about doubling the fees. They're talking about doubling the fines. They're talking about maybe reducing the amounts of those fines, but also encourage you to work and would be happy to, if it's necessary, to get these two folks together to bring them back together like we did when we first came up with the RVP back in 1999 through 2001, and get them in a discussion so that we can resolve these issues so that you don't have to settle the problems of the City of Portland's alcohol impact areas.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Representative. And I don't think these problems and challenges are unique to Portland, or they're in Salem and Eugene and Lord knows where else. But so would you be in support of, and I don't know if everybody will be, but that's not what I'm here for, you allow the city to have their alcohol impact area and the rules that go in there, as for example, selling the banning of certain alcoholic beverages. Would you, if we can somehow tie it together with this program, would you be supportive of something like that?
Mr. Chair, representing Vice Chair Shoffler, I would be supportive of a discussion which would allow the responsible vendor program to administer a program which would be responsible within and responsive to the concerns of each and every community. I'm concerned that there would be an attempt in some cases with established long-term businesses, successful businesses who have demonstrated their desire to voluntarily participate in the RVP, to now either lose their ability to be responsible vendors or lose their ability to manage their business in such a fashion that would be responsible. And I think that we're all on the same page in coming forward. The grocers, the responsible vendors, and the OLCC are all there together.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
I'm going to have Joe Gilliam come up and explain the Dash 1 amendments, hopefully. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam. Could be the former director of the Urban Grocery Association after the Dash 1s. I don't actually have a copy of the Dash 1s. I've seen a copy of them. They are not our amendments, or at least not how we requested them. I need to clarify for the record, Mr. Chair, that on the third page, there is a penalty provision of the Dash 1 amendments that suggests 60 days imprisonment for selling to a minor. For the record, these are not our amendments. I really like my job, actually. So, thank you, sir. The front part of it is are the amendments which we're trying to get to. We're trying to hopefully improve this bill and provide some enhancements and some improvements to the responsible vendor program. What we're trying to do in the Dash 1s is to expand and improve the responsible vendor program. Currently, and what's misunderstood about the responsible vendor program is it was passed as a vehicle to get at selling to minors. Incentive program that if you go the extra mile, you'll mitigate your damages, but you're going to do more training, you're going to do more signage, you're going to do a whole new process in order to step up and go the extra mile. In the administrative rules, even though the statute only speaks to sales to minors, in the administrative rules, it does say that your training must cover sales to minors and visibly intoxicated individuals. So what this amendment does is pull that requirement as a statutory requirement into the statute to clarify that you're going to do both. It's not just focused at minors. It's also focused at how not to sell, how to recognize, how to turn down without huge conflict, sales to visibly intoxicated individuals. And that's a key piece to what Representative Hance was talking about. It was focused on minors. We're saying, no, you got to focus it on both. You have the large majority of retailers are involved in the Responsible Vendor Program. It's been very successful. And we want to keep that program as an incentive, as a voluntary program, that you want to be there. You want to be doing the right thing. You want to be doing the training, not a place you're forced or shoved into, and then you figure out ways to get around doing the training, doing the record keeping, doing what you're supposed to be doing. If you're a vendor who wants to skirt the law and say, or a retailer wants to skirt the law and say, I'm going to sell to minors or I'm going to sell to street drinkers, you're probably not going to have very much success in trying to enforce the rules of the Responsible Vendor Program on that same retailer. Obviously, they don't have much concern for the law as it's written. So well, we took a different approach saying, let's expand the Responsible Vendor Program to cover not only minors, but also visibly intoxicated individuals, and give you an exemption that if you're in the program doing the right things, you're stepping up voluntarily, that you would have an exemption from an AIA and from you already have a mitigation on the rest of the laws and penalties. But if you aren't going to be in the process and you refuse to go into a responsible vendor program, then your fines are going to go up. And in our amendments, what we submitted was a 20% increase. In fact, let me give you these, Mr. Chair. On the second page of that, gives you an idea of the difference between the new and the old fines that would be levied on someone who's not a responsible vendor program. So you kind of have to ask yourself, why wouldn't you want to be in this program? If it sounds this easy, why not just jump in with both feet and do it? Honestly, I don't have a good answer for that. Why people don't? It's not costly. It doesn't take any money to get into the program. There's no fee. There's no application cost. The application is this long. Two pages. Now, there are extra recording requirements. If you look on the second page of my testimony, you'll see kind of a list of requirements once you're in the RVP of what you have to do. Yes, you have to put up more signage. Yes, you have to train four times a year. Go over it every quarter. You got to go over the training on selling to minors and visibly intoxicated people. You put signage up. You post, not just in a notebook, but you actually post your store's policy on sales. And you have to have a higher level of people you check. You don't just check people who look 21. You check people who look 26. Most stores have a higher threshold than that. They're checking at age 30 now. So you go through this whole list of things you have to do, and we think there should be recognition of that. The stores that are in the St. John's area, for example, who are in the RVP, are not the stores they've had a problem with. But they're thrust into a group to try to negotiate an AIA rules on products and products they may or may not sell when they're not the problem. And frankly, it's the folks who aren't a member of the RVP that are causing the problem. You have a great program here that's working voluntarily. The industry has stepped up on this issue, has helped out on the policy issue of minors. We're willing to step up on the intoxicated individual issue and keep this program, the integrity program, there. So that's really what our amendments do. Now, in the penalty phase of that bill, those are all wrong. What we're looking at, in my testimony will show you, is a 20% bump on each of the financial penalties, and going from, if it's a suspension, going from 10 days to 12 days, and from 30 days to 35 days to increase that. And those are all lost sales. So those are, each day is a pretty heavy hit for a retailer. But if you aren't going to get in the program and you're going to make the violation, we think that's going to be more of an incentive either to clean up your act and get in the RVP, or take your chances, and you won't be in business very long if you do that. The Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chair, I'll just comment that we've looked at Dash 2 and we would be fine with those also.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Chalmers.
These are the Dash 1s. This doesn't look, this mad marker work doesn't look familiar to you, Mr. Gilliam. Forgive me, Mr. Chair. My question is on the impact, alcohol impact areas, your clients. Are they willing to, for example, not sell Night Train, not sell single cans? I mean, I lived in Northwest Portland for 3 years, 17th and Everett, and believe me, I saw exactly every day, every night, what mm-hmm. going on out there. And I somehow, we got to try to get our hands around this problem. Where is your clients at with working with the cities and getting there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, let me highlight where we're at. The OGA members that are a member of the Responsible Vendor Program in the St. John's area, each one of them have taken different steps to change their product mix. Some still do sell some larger products, but most of them do not actually. The larger stores in that area do not sell the 40-ounce. And they do sell some individual, but it's usually high-end European or microbrew or craft beers that are probably $6 or $7 per container. That kind of, you know, not something a street drinker is going to come in and buy. So these folks have already made those kinds of changes, and the marketplace will work. Part of the success of that, though, is when you're in the responsible vendor, you have your clerks looking out there looking. They're being trained every four times a year. And so they're not looking to make that quick sale on a single can of 40 ounce. And in order for them to stay in a responsible vendor program and get all the benefits of it, you can't be selling to minors and to people who are going to go out and cause problems. You're going to lose your status. And that's a huge, as you can see, the mitigating factors, you're going to lose potentially huge protection. So you have those folks who are doing it. I think it's a great division. And if you can get some people saying, hey, look, we better get in this program in St. John's because we want protection, we want a freedom to manage our product mix, you got to do all the extra stuff. Mm-hmm. If you say, no, I'm going to sell 40. Selling 40-ounce steel reserve is the most important thing in my life. I'm just not going to do it. Then you're going to have to go into the AIA, and you're going to be restricted.
Mr. Chair, I believe you, Mr. Gilliam, but what I want is some numbers and some evidence of the numbers of clients that are doing these voluntarily restrictions in these neighborhoods relative to those that aren't. If you have anything
we can get that. I think we can get that for you. Mr. Chair, I think we can do that.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, the last comment I make is just so you understand, in the St. John's area, there's... To understand the problem, there are 7 individuals that are the problem in that area, and 2 have died since the whole process began. There's 5 individuals that have been the crux of the street drinking problem. So it's not 45 people all over the place. It's one small group.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Could I have Steve Lanning and Jeff Anderson now, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Jeff Anderson had another meeting and couldn't be here, so I've asked Steve Canopa from the same union, United Food and Commercial Workers, to join me if that's all right with you, Mr. Chair. We support House Bill 3356 as it's currently written. We also would support the Dash 2 amendments. However, we would not support the Dash 1 amendments as we've heard them, because it appears that the Dash 1 amendments still don't require the necessary training that we would like to see. Originally, 4 years ago, we introduced a bill that was an absolute mandate, a blanket mandate. All grocery clerks needed to be trained before they were working in the grocery stores through the Responsible Vendor Program. And we knew that was a problem, and so we took the advice then, 4 years ago, of the chair of the House Commerce Committee, Representative Bill Witt, and he suggested not to make it an absolute blanket mandate. And so we recrafted the bill 4 years ago that had some employee protections and had some training and some encouragement for training in it, and the House Commerce Committee passed it out to the House floor, and it passed unanimously. It later died in the Senate. But that was our attempt 4 years ago to do something about the lack of required training for grocery clerks. This session, we introduced the exact same bill on the Senate side. However, it has a fiscal impact, and it has been sent to Ways and Means. But it was exactly the same bill that passed 4 years ago unanimously on the House side. We like House Bill 3356 as it's currently written. It's definitely a step in the right direction when it comes to training grocery clerks. The Dash 2 amendments take out new licensees, and it's still a step in the right direction. Maybe not as big a step, but it is. It's all about keeping alcohol out of the hands of minors, and the way to do it is the upfront training. And if a licensee gets caught in an OLCC sting and is convicted of selling alcohol to a minor, or their employees are, it makes sense to do the training and not let them out, not let them voluntarily decide whether or not they want to do the training. And that's the way to keep the alcohol out of the hands of minors. The Oregon AFL-CIO has taken up this position at its annual conventions a number of years, and what I've done is I've included a copy from our 2000 convention down in Albany. Even though United Food and Commercial Workers might only make up 10-15% of our total membership, all the union members and all the delegates that were at the convention voted on a resolution that would deal with training grocery clerks and also deal with another issue that this bill doesn't deal with, and that is relieving some of the penalties that are currently in place. Currently, if a grocery clerk gets caught unknowingly making a sale to a minor, it's a misdemeanor. It's a misdemeanor. It's a criminal offense. And the first for the first offense, the fine's $350. And so it's pretty serious, and they take it very serious. And so we encourage you to move this bill forward with or without the Dash 2 amendments. With your permission, I'd like to have a representative from the United Food and Commercial Workers speak to what it's like for the clerks.
Certainly.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Canopa, the current United Food and Commercial Workers field representative for this area. And we do represent 20,000 workers in the state of Oregon, 10,000 of which would be directly affected with this bill because they're cashiers, obviously. We are in favor of this bill. And like my brother from AFL-CIO, we don't necessarily have a problem with Dash 2. Dash 1, we're not really all that excited about it. Our main focus has always been on training. We don't want alcohol being sold to minors. But due to the pressures of retail, the youth scans that our cashiers are more and more getting in the stores due to technology where they oversee 4 or up to 8 units, read and sign policies, WIC vouchers, you name it, things that our checkers currently are asked to do on a day-to-day basis, we think training is the key here, and the responsible responsible vendor program to me is just the utmost important issue here. So without being redundant and going on too long, I would just like to say that the United Food and Commercial Workers are in favor of this bill. We'd like to see it moved. Thank you.
Questions? Don't say anything. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Can I have Bill Perry, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I've got all the amendments out here. I just wanted, for informational purposes, kind of want to lay out, because I see one thing that the dash ones, too, that the exclude me, and the dash twos don't. And one of the, I think, interesting things about the on-premise and off-premise, there really is two distinct markets. When you look at off-premise, I mean, obviously, they're bigger establishments. Usually they have great internal training programs, and I think they're very effective. That's why they've kind of went the responsible vendor route. When you look up my membership, they're almost all independents, and actually pre the responsible vendor, the Restaurant Association and others supported a mandatory server training. So I actually individually train our servers as it goes through. We've got a renewal and everything else. So the training in the on-premise industry has always been kind of an individual mandated training. With the off-premise, they've been more of a voluntary and kind of an organized structural, because they have, you know, individual systems that there's going to be individual trainings that work differently. So most of the training done by us for the sales to minors, age verification, responsible, or visibly intoxicated persons are all done by authorized programs that have, are sent through the OLCC. So a majority of my membership are not members of the Responsible Vendor Program. We think it's a great program. We encourage them to do it, but it's kind of a redundant training for a lot of my small members, and it's also extra record keeping. So from our perspective, when you read the Dash 2 amendments, it says anybody that's not in this program, you could lose your license for any sales to a minor, which we try to stop sales to minors and everything else, but that's going to put a different hardship on my members than it would on the off-premise licensees. So as it deals with the responsible vendor program, I mean, for the most part, I would like to be excluded, because we have mandatory training, so a lot of our members aren't in the responsible vendor program. I think it's a wonderful program, but I know you've heard the last two speakers talk about grocery clerks. I think the committee needs to understand that the way alcohol sales in on-premise and off-premise are done today and training is two totally different operations. And so I think as we move forward, they need to be viewed that way. So as the Dash 2s are written, as it deals with full on-premise and limited on-premise, that's an addition that the Dash 1s don't have. And so I would ask that the committee try to separate these two sections of the industry out, just because we do have mandatory training. And the sales to minors are going to be different. You know, I would say grocery stores worry a lot more about shoulder tappers, and I've got the problem of friends letting friends in. They're two different animals. We both have our problems that we're trying to address, but to group them all together in one is going to be difficult to do from my perspective. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Bill. Could I have John Laws, Jim Hayden, and Cliff Madsen? Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Who wants to start?
I'll just start with introductions. Jim Hayden. I'm from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm the Neighborhood DA at North and Northeast Precincts in Portland. And if you're not familiar with Neighborhood DAs, we're stationed at police precincts, and our job is to collaborate directly with the police and the community, trying to attempt to solve quality of life issues in the neighborhoods.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Cliff Madsen. I'm commander of North Precinct of Portland Police Bureau, which includes the St. John's area.
Good morning. I'm Officer John Laws. I'm an investigator for the city of Portland, and I specialize and have been working with alcohol for the last 3 years out of our Drug and Vice Division. The city of Portland is opposed to Dash 1. in the areas of, specifically the sub 3, a holder of an off-premise sales license is described in ORS 471186, who participates in the vendor program will be not have the imposition of alcohol and bacteria rules. To start the responsible vendor program, personally, I believe is a great tool. It's a great program. It's meant and it's designed to address sales to minors, which is a great thing. In this amendment, the dash one, you'll see the words "or any person who is visibly intoxicated" being added. The purpose is to try to get the alcohol impact area included in this. In reality, there's already an existing ORS 471410 sub 1 that makes it illegal to sell to a very intoxicated person. So it's very kind of redundant to add it into this minor drinking program to try to reduce the problem. Street drinking is an issue for the city. And particularly, we have concentrations in the St. John's Cathedral Park neighborhood areas, which is a smaller geographic portion of the city. We had in the city alcohol impact areas, and we've had them for years. We had them under city ordinances. We have actually have three designated, but they've become paper tigers when the legislature passed the law, really for Portland, that gives the OLCC the authority to oversee the alcohol impact areas. The law's passed, it's an onerous process, and the city, Jim Hayden's really been one of the leaders in seeing this through, has gone on for almost a year and a half. And we finally, the city council passed the recommendation to the commission, and they are now ready to consider it. The problem we're addressing with an alcohol impact area is street drinking. The problem that's trying to be addressed by the responsible vendor program is minors buying alcohol. They're two different issues. An attempt to make this good program deal with a whole nother issue or supersede the issue just doesn't make sense. The selling to minors, the minors out in St. John's and the minors citywide are not the problem with street drinkers. And frankly, street drinkers always aren't intoxicated when they're going in and purchasing their alcohol. In fact, I have been to almost every store that's in the proposed alcohol impact area. I have looked what's on their shelves, and I don't see a lot of microbrews. I'm seeing the large containers. I'm seeing the high alcohol brands that I'm a beer drinker. I don't drink them because I don't like them. They're marketed for a specific market. People who are drinking to get intoxicated. It's become a huge issue for the city. Our only venue right now of dealing with it is product restrictions, and that's the whole basis of what an alcohol impact area in reducing the problem. And Hayden Olson has various it's based on product restrictions. What they're proposing to do here is exempt these stores from product restrictions. I've talked to vendors in the area and have told me I don't want to be limited if the guy across the street can sell it. But if we're all on the same equal playing field, it allows us to sell. They're still going to be selling. One-third, industry figures show one-third of all alcohol sales are Budweiser and Bud Light. Those aren't going to be affected. The standard alcohols that most people, the average citizen purchases, aren't going to be affected by this. It's going to be, in much of you're a wine drinker and you're drinking Mad Dog Mogan David 2020 or Night Train has been mentioned. Those aren't standard drinkers of wine to go purchase those products. They're really made for people who are trying to get intoxicated. What the alcohol impact area does is try to address the street drinking problem based on product restrictions to displace it out of the area. By having them sign up for a program of a responsible vendor targeted to sales to minors and say, okay, now you don't have to have product restrictions to street drinkers, it doesn't make sense. It's apples and oranges, and it's trying to change it. If we want to change or the alcohol impact area, that's in the legislative authority to change the alcohol impact area law. But why take a program that has nothing to do with alcohol impact areas and try to change another program?
And again, good morning. Jim Hayden, Multnomah County DA's office, Chairman Brown and representatives. I think the reason is because the grocery industry has, from the beginning, not wanted to be part of the AIA. Representative Schaffer was asking questions regarding this. Well, I have personally been working on this for almost 4 years. I've been to every neighborhood group that would listen to me. I've been to every business that would talk to me and proposed this alcohol impact area because citizens got tired of seeing drunks on their streets. From the beginning, the grocery industry has refused to voluntarily restrict the sales of alcohol, of fortified wine and fortified malt liquor, which is probably 80 to 90% of the problem in St. John's. This process spans back to before 2002. We have complied with this OLCC provision, trying to get them to voluntarily restrict sales, but they have absolutely refused. And the reason is because they cite the level playing field argument. The level playing field argument is, until everyone else agrees to this, I will not agree to it. Because if I agree to it, no one else does, all the business will go to my competitor. So, for that long, we've been trying to cooperatively work with these businesses to get them to voluntarily restrict sales in an area of Portland that has a demonstrable problem with street drinking. They have refused. City Council voted unanimously 4-0 to propose this to the OLCC. What we would like to do is get to the OLCC and have our full public hearing. Let the grocery industry come in and tell us why it's not a good idea to restrict sales of fortified malt liquor and wine in an area that has been devastated by its impact. What I see this -1 amendment as is simply a backdoor way for them to get out of this. This adding any person who is visibly intoxicated adds nothing to this provision. It's already a crime to do that. I prosecute people on a regular basis in our community court for this. What does it add to this bill? The only thing it adds to this bill is the ability to then say, well, if we add that to be in the RVP, you can't sell to visibly intoxicated people. That means that if you do that, we should exempt us from the AIA. It is clear as day to me why they're doing this. They testified against it at City Council. They are currently in the process of submitting information to the OLCC to get the OLCC not to allow us to have a full public hearing on an alcohol impact area. Why is that? I listened to Mr. Gilliam speak about St. John's and their voluntary efforts. I don't know if he's been to St. John's recently. I don't know what stores he's talking about that don't sell fortified wine and malt liquor. Maybe Freddy's and Safeway. But if you go to the small stores, then that's not where they're buying their alcohol. They're buying it at the small stores, at the Plaids and 7-Elevens and the mom and pops. Every single one of those stores sells fortified malt liquor and fortified wine because that's how they stay in business. And it's a huge problem in the area. And so the other issue that this would, again, albeit that it's already a crime to sell to visibly intoxicated people, that this somehow would take care of that problem, wouldn't address the issue of street drinking and chronic public inebriates. There are not 7 people that caused the problem in St. John's, I can assure you. I work there on a daily basis. This is a larger problem than that. Plaid Pantry in 2002 attempted to solve this on their own by beginning not to restrict product, but restrict sales to who they had identified as chronic public inebriates. Street drinking incidents continue to go up. I do not believe that this is something that on their own,
Mr. Chair,
that can regulate, that the
representative gets.
How did they identify these people?
They did it on their own.
How do they do it on their own?
I do not know. They draw people outside. I think probably two ways. If you know the answer, jump in. But I think two ways. They had been meeting with neighborhood association, particularly St. John's, for quite some time. And St. John's was giving them information on who were the street drinkers in the area. And so I think that Plaid Pantry began to develop their own list of who they're not going to sell to. So they began to restrict sales to those people. This is according to Chris Gerard, CEO of Plaid Pantry, who's I've got the letter regarding it. So I believe that's how they identified it. They may have also tried to do it on their own, but I think through listening to the St. John's residents and who they were identifying as coming out of their stores as the chronic public inebriates, they attempted to quit making sales to those people. And again, during that time, street drinking reports in the area rose. So the thought that the Grocers Association is ever going to voluntarily agree to this, they're not. They are attempting to stop this on every front, and this is just another effort of them to attempt to stop this. I oppose, and our office opposes, only this sub 3 amendment or the whole dash 1 amendment. It is unnecessary. Let us get to a full public hearing. Public hearing. If I had had more time, and if you gave me time, I'll bring down neighbors that will talk about the effects on their community from illicit street drinking and chronic public inebriation. Let us get to the OLCC. Let us have this hearing and let the grocers come in and say their piece, and let us have our neighbors and our business owners come in and say what they have to say, rather than in this method trying to bury this in this dash one amendment, which is clearly what they're attempting to do. And so for those reasons and any others that people care to ask me.
Representative Esco.
Yes, I have a couple questions. How large is this St. John's area?
I don't have square mileage. It's two neighborhood associations, roughly, Cedar Park and St. John's. So
that doesn't tell me anything.
I know it doesn't. I'm gonna guess at a couple square miles.
Okay,
maybe a little more than that.
My next question is, do you have laws against drinking in public?
We do.
Okay. My third question is, then, why aren't we saturating this with police in order to administer the law?
I'm going to ask
both of you. You are a police officer. Please explain why you aren't concentrating your effort into this area to clean the neighborhood.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Cliff Madison, Commander of North Precinct, and in fact we are working best we can, but what we're looking at right now is a real community livability issue. The citizens have really stood up, been extremely supportive in us trying to do something about the street drinking in that city. I don't have enough officers out there that can just work on a Skid Row type situation or a street drinking situation on Lombard, North Lombard, which is one of the main drags for this. But we need to help. We have not gotten the support from the other associations as far as having them work cooperatively with us to stop some of the alcohol sales. All the stores are selling the fortified alcohols. And if you allow them to become part of this one group and then they're not part of the alcohol impact area, that's going to cripple us. Because, in fact, it's really just going to run all the business to them. But I don't have enough officers that can just go out and patrol that street and take the calls for service that we also have.
And if I can add to that, this alcohol impact area is getting at restricting the supply of the fortified wine and malt liquor. The illicit street drinkers don't always have the open containers on them. I mean, part of the problem with these alcohol impact areas that I have identified is that it's the status of chronic public inebriation that is also devastating to a community. And the collateral effects of these people, you know, they will urinate in public, they'll defecate in public, they steal from the area stores to get more money to buy more alcohol. They wander into traffic. They aggressively panhandle people. These are all symptoms of not just open, and that's not open container, that's simply chronic public inebriation. The city, this began in Portland in the late 1980s, and some businesses there began to voluntarily regulate themselves and met with great success. OLCC created the rule in 1995, the administrative rule. The city of Tacoma in Washington actually adopted the same, almost identical administrative rule. So did Seattle. I've got the figures on what's happened there, but I can assure you that by very substantial numbers, the number of emergency medical calls for service went down, calls for police service went down, there was less drastic effect on detoxification centers, and all of the neighbors and business owners that lived there noted an improved community. So not only did you have people feeling they had a better quality of life, but you had substantial savings in the emergency medical responders in Tacoma and Seattle and in Portland and Old Town when it was instituted there in a voluntary method. So the police don't have the resources to police this. And besides which, in Portland, and I'm sure in other cities in this state, you know, we really embrace this concept of community policing. Let's work with the community. We can't do it on our own, and we want you to be involved in solving your problem with us. And so they came to us and said, here's how we want to solve this problem. We've seen the administrative rule. Would you work on it with us? And so we said, yes, we will. That's where we're at. So the police are not going to be able to on their own, and I don't think they have the resources on their own to solve this problem. Nor do I think that they should on their own solve this problem. I think we're going to have a better community if we work on this together.
One thing I'd like to add, Mr. Chair and committee members, that the far north end of Portland, St. John's area in particular, is an area that's really made a turnaround. The citizens there have worked extremely hard to change the environment of that community, and part of that is eliminating some of the street drinking. We're doing everything we can as much as our resources allow us to. We've run missions during the summer. We've tried to knock down some of the numbers, but the citizens have been so strong in support of all of our efforts to make a change in that area, but they have not had the support from the business community, the support they need there.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Yes. So let me sum this up. We have laws in place that prohibit people from selling to intoxicated individuals. We have ordinance in place disallowing drunk in public and drinking in public. Am I correct on that?
Not drunk in public. The only thing we have with drunk in public is it's a intoxication if the person is unable to care for themselves.
Okay, so, and then it's your job to take them to a detox center.
Please.
I assume you have, the police has that.
Only if they're in such a state they cannot care for themselves.
And who determines that, the officer himself?
The officer does.
Okay, then what you're saying is you don't have enough resources. Does that just mean it's priorities?
Well, I think to a degree you're talking priorities in the fact that, you know, our response time to the serious, crimes such as assault and robberies, those have to be our priorities. Those are priority one type calls. But we also have to deal with the folks out on the street that are intoxicated. But we can eliminate a lot of that, and we don't have that issue as far as calls for service if we can, in fact, eliminate some of the sales of alcohol in that area. Because what's happened is it's an area that has a long-standing reputation of folks coming and drinking there. So by trying to defeat that, we can eliminate a lot of the street drinking, which also clears up cars that aren't running somebody from the street all the way over to detox and then coming back into service. Because every time they take somebody, they're probably gone an hour out of service.
Sir, if I could kind of answer your question. I had some statistical for 2003 to 2004 I haven't finished. Every day I get a stack of reports that have to do with detoxes and have to do with drinking in public, and we put them into a database. In 2003 in the city of Portland, we had 7,598 alcohol incidents in our database. Of these incidents, 64.8% or 4,923 required public caretaking actions as taken to detox. In 41 cases, the individuals were other things like taken to hospital for alcohol poisoning. In 37.5 cases, or 2,846, the individuals were cited for drinking in public. It means they get a ticket. As you can see, if we cannot, we're not take them to jail. So therefore, we give them a ticket. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but if is that going to stop them? That enforcement action doesn't stop the problem of street drinking when you give them tickets. What it does is we keep arresting them on failing to appear on those tickets in the future. In 33 cases, injuries were both cited and taken to detox in addition to that. And in 2,606 cases, or 34.3%, the individuals were identified as transients, either as saying they were homeless or using a homeless shelter as an address. So the idea, and that includes the city center, which is, it's a much more of a concentration. In St. John's area, from memory, it's in the 20% range, when the idea that five or six transients is the whole problem. They're part of the problem, but not by any means the whole problem. we are looking, writing people tickets doesn't solve the problem. The problem is best solved. The best tool that we have is the alcohol impact area to reduce product. In St. John's, two brands made up over 50% of the street drinking. We can reduce those products. We displace those people out of that neighborhood. And it becomes a livability issue. There's crime and there's a fear of crime. I grew up in a neighborhood. We had a couple drunks. Everybody knew them. Nobody was afraid of them. And it wasn't an issue. When you start getting groups, you start getting four or five getting drunk on the corner, start getting aggressive panhandling, people are intimidated, they start walking away, they start avoiding the area. And the businesses in downtown St. John's, which this is impact areas around, are suffering. Those selling alcohol are doing okay, but other businesses in that area are suffering. That's what we're dealing with. We're not talking a few, four or five people.
I think we're running short of time, so I'm going to have to wrap up the hearing. I appreciate the testimony, and then thank you, gentlemen, for being here this morning. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3356.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3092, and Janet, give us a rundown on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last session, the legislature directed the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules making electrical and plumbing code plan reviews mandatory only for complex structures. The bill allowed but did not require owners of complex structures to request plan reviews and inspections for electrical and plumbing installations that are subject to state building codes. House Bill 3092 would exempt even the complex structures from the plumbing plan review requirement if the system is designed by a professional engineer or registered architect. It does not affect the electrical system plans, but just the plumbing system plans. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the bill was requested by the Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have J.L. Wilson, John Agee, Kurt Schieber, and Jay Hansen? I don't know if we can get all four up there or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. House Bill 3092 is our bill, dealing with a frustration that contractors are experiencing on a daily basis with regard to the plan review process. And the problem that we're trying to remedy is simply this. A plumbing contractor submits their plans at the relevant local jurisdiction for a plan review. That plan review is done, completed, the plans are approved and certified, and then the contractor takes those plans out to the job site, and the job will get stopped, or there will be a stop work order issued, even though the plans are being implemented according to the plan that was approved by the local jurisdiction. So the question comes into play, why are we spending money on a plan review that ultimately has no effect on the field and doesn't preclude a local government entity from stopping work on a project where we've just gone through the process of a plan review, paid good money for it, and had it approved? And there's a disconnect there that we're trying to remedy with House Bill 3092. And what we're proposing with the bill is simply this. We're saying that if you have a plan that is created and stamped by an engineer according to Oregon Plumbing Specialty Code, that you can in fact bypass the plan review process and take your product out to the field. Now, if you don't, if you choose, you can have a plan review at the local level, but either way, we are asking that once the plan is reviewed and approved with the local government entity, that we're just, all we're asking is that the plumbing contractor can proceed with the project as it was approved, because too often we find ourselves in a situation where they implement the plan as it was approved, and stop work orders are issued because the work is found not according to code. So there's a significant issue here that we're trying to remedy, where you spend time and money on the plan review process only to have that plan review basically rendered meaningless on the job site, and it comes at an expense of both time and money. It's a significant frustration for my clients, and I have three real-life plumbing contractors here to give a real-world perspective on the issue. Thank you.
Next.
Chairman Brown, my name is Jay Hansen. I work with C.J. Hansen Company. We're a third-generation mechanical contractor here in Salem and a longtime member of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. Appreciate you having us here and testifying in support of House Bill 3092. A little bit more than the cost that plans review, the burden of the cost of plans review, impacts our process. Time is much more of an impact on our process. Plans review do take a minimum of 2 weeks and sometimes can be as far out as 6 weeks. Once those plans are finally reviewed and we can finally go to work on our project, plumbing and mechanical systems being a core element of any project, any steps on down the road that hinder that production are going to push back the timeline of the completion of the project, and that has an impact on the efficiency of the project, and it has an impact on the bottom line of the project, and it has an impact on customer satisfaction. I would hope that the committee would take a positive view of House Bill 3092, as this will help our bottom line product delivery to our customers in terms of efficiency and quality. And I appreciate the time and allowing us to come and speak to in support of this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, committee members, for the record, my name is John Egge. I am majority stockholder and CEO of a medium-sized plumbing firm in the Metro Portland area. Jay has articulated the process. I think a more important outcome of what we bought into when we decided to support the whole concept of plan reviews, we thought it would actually save us time in the long run when this originally was thought up a few years ago. And what's actually happened is it's extended the time frame, not just the actual plan review, but if you can kind of imagine a situation where we do an installation based upon the plans that have been checked and reviewed, and we go out and install it, and then the inspector comes along and says, I don't care what the plan reviewer said, this is what the code says, change it. Now, you might say, well, stand up for your rights and let's make an issue out of this. Well, the fact is that the general contractor is there saying, look, I want to pour concrete day after tomorrow. And so what you wind up getting to do is just eat it and change it. That's the practical nature of it. And that's the issue that keeps coming up, not just occasionally, but time after time after time on a very regular basis. And not just in some jurisdictions, but almost in all jurisdictions. Now, I won't say all jurisdictions, but there are examples in every county in the state, I think, of this exact thing coming up. So I would hope and ask for your favorable consideration of 3092, and I stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Kurt, want to switch places there and with someone?
My name's Kurt Cheever, and I run the several Roto-Rooter shops in Oregon. We service about 70% of Oregon's population. We also own Clark County, Vancouver. Our company is more predominantly small remodels and service in general. And the impact that we feel most is customer service. And these guys have eloquently put it in better terms than I can. But I want to relate one little story. I live here in Marion County. I just added 700 square feet to my house, doing all the work myself. Had a structural issue that we had an engineer look at, got pre-approved in the plans. It was basically a commercial application for a residence. I built this thing. The inspector comes out for the final structure and says, I can't do it that way. Now, this has all been approved. It's engineered. It's a separate sheet on the plans. and it cost me 4 months worth of time and about $6,000 additional cost to my residents to redo it. And this is what our customers will deal with on some of those same issues. And we look like we're not providing an adequate service. We do the plan review, everything's supposed to be the way it is, then somebody comes out and changes it. And then we have to take the time and the money and the egg on the face from the customer to try and explain it. So we'd like it settled.
Representative Escobar.
You know, I can relate very, very much what you're saying. And the reason being is because I've had complaints in municipalities where an individual take their plans into an engineer, they'll get them redlined, go back, make the appropriate changes, take it into another engineer that has a different interpretation of the same rules, and get redlined as well. Go to a third engineer, get redlined, and it goes as far as four and five engineers at one whack. I think what we need to do is craft something that's universal, not just for plumbing, but electrical and structural as well. I'm for looking into something in the future where you give a certain specificity on time frame for the municipality to react to your plans, because sometimes they take forever to get it done. And the other thing is that once it has been reviewed, it has been reviewed. Now, if it's not in compliance of code, then that should fall back on the municipality. It shouldn't fall back on the consumer, nor should it fall back on the contractor. But I think that this is something that's been an inherent problem within the whole building industry as a whole, and I would like to correct the whole picture.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank Jay for doing a wonderful job on my restaurant that I opened up last session, and went off without a hitch, and is still going off very well. So thank you, and you do a great job. Mr. Chair, I just got to pile on here, and I'm going to tell my little story, which is very applicable to this concept. I was working, I had a little concrete tear out and replace, and I was not in the right of way. I was on the house side of the right-of-way. Did not need a permit to tear this out and replace. That's all I was doing. A nice inspector in a nice car from a city north of here in the community I was in drives by and looked right, and I was going to pour concrete the very next morning. We were almost ready to, we were almost done. It's about, I don't know, 11:30. We were almost done for the day. I love that, getting done early. And anyway, he drives by and looks at me, and I go, oh, God, here we go. He backs up, doesn't even get out of the car. He goes, you need a permit for that. And I said, well, for all due respect, sir, I'm not in the right of way. I've been a planning commissioner. I've been a city councilor. I understand what I'm doing, and I've been a contractor for years. And he goes, well, I think you need a permit. And I go, okay. And he gets his card, go call this number. I go, no, I'll just go downtown and get it. And I went downtown to the permit center in downtown Portland, a great time and expense to me. Walk in, get in queue, and it's lunchtime now, so there are only half of them working. They're staggering their lunches, which is fair enough. Wait, the guy comes out, gives my name. We go back to his cubicle. He takes a look at it. He goes, I don't think you need a permit, but I'll go look. He goes back, comes back. I don't think you need a permit. I'm positive. He goes, well, let me go look one more time. Comes back. Sure enough, the right-of-way on this street is different than all the others in the neighborhood. And he goes, you know, it looks like the sidewalk wasn't put in the right place. You're about 2 feet in the actual right-of-way. I buy a permit for $70 or $75 or whatever it was. And I call the 24-hour. I cancel my concrete, by the way, because I wasn't sure I was going to be able to get inspected. I cancel that, putting off my work, my payday. I call the 24-hour inspector, and lo and behold, he did have enough time. This is a different inspector now, by mind you, not the initial one. He calls me up, leaves a message on my phone, and guess what he says? You don't need a permit. Now, I'm telling you, I was not very happy that day. And I canceled my mud, and I wasn't getting it back. I had to cancel the pump, everything, finishers, and I was furious, to say the least. I've expressed that to the good people in that community that run that town. And anyway, I'll shut up now, but this is a good idea. I absolutely support it. And we should go not just in this area of it. It should be everywhere.
Any other representing Holden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I agree with lot of this as well. I think if you have a stamped plan from an engineer, that ought to suffice, and an architect. But there is one piece of language in this bill that does cause me a little bit of concern, and maybe you can explain it, or maybe it can be changed a little bit, because I think it leaves a door, a pretty wide door here. And it's in on line 27 on the first page. It's section 2, sub paragraph 1, sub A. It goes on to say that basically an inspector or municipality administering the building codes, to sum it up, can't halt a project if the project's in violation of code, if the project is being installed in accordance with a reviewed and approved plan. That particular line right there makes me wonder who's to say, or who's saying that it's being installed in accordance with the reviewed plan or approved code. You know, if you had that engineer who put the stamp on the plan, or somebody that was qualified to do it, if the inspector is not the one to do that, I would be okay with that. But it doesn't really say that. So I'm wondering, I can see a plumber going, standing down there, I'm installing this according to the plan, but is he really the authority to say that he is in compliance with that engineered stamped plan? So you see where I'm going with that? That's just an issue there that I think needs to be cleared up just a little bit, if in fact the engineer or the architect is the one that's saying, yes, this is in accordance with the plan that I've got my stamp on, then I'm okay with it. But if it's the apprentice plumber down there, which it could be, saying this is in accordance with the plan, pour the concrete, because I've had to jackhammer a concrete up to fix plumbing before, so and that's not a pretty sight either. So I don't know, maybe you can address that for me a little clearer, or make some suggestion to solve my concern there.
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Holvey. We're going to have some amendments to the bill regardless, and clarifying that is no skin off our back. With regard to the bill itself and what changes we'd propose, we are probably going to eliminate the architects from the bill. I think that we should... this bill needs to specify that it's an engineer doing a plan according to Oregon Plumbing Specialty Code, which is not in the bill. Also, this bill provides that a local jurisdiction could shove off a plan review on the state BCD, which clearly was not our intent and would probably entail a fiscal on there, and we're not interested in that component either. So there are parts of this bill we clearly have to change, and being more specific and airtight on that, I think is fine.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Can I have Bill Cross and Libby Hendrick, please? No.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association, and we are very concerned about the bill. Some of the amendments, I think, will help address some aspects of the bill, but we still have a problem with the overall philosophy of eliminating the checks and balances that are traditionally found nationally in programs where you have a financial interested party doing the plan review or the plan design, and now they're doing their own plan review. And furthermore, this bill then says, and by the way, you can't in field inspect outside that plan. And there's no assurance that, of course, the plan was correctly prepared by the engineer or the architect. In this case, it sounds like the engineer. So we're concerned about that approach to what has been typically the role of code officials in terms of trying to provide a check and balance. If indeed the committee were interested in eliminating that aspect, of code administration. The bill might want to include language, much like was done with Senate Bill 711 last session, on simple plans, where architects for simple plans, residential plans, can do a plan review. In this case, it's still inspected, but they can do a plan review and stamp it, but it has to be clear that they are liable for that plan, not somebody else. And this bill is not clear about who the liability rests with for that plan review. We're also concerned that the bill doesn't address what happens right now out on a lot of projects. You have contractors that want to use alternate means or materials or methods, especially when you're talking about complex projects, which is looking at. And right now, the building official is the individual who can approve alternate means and materials and products. And they have criteria that they use to do that. Now, will the engineer do that? Will the contractor be able to use that, and basically the engineer approve those alternate means and methods and materials, which would there again, we think, pose a liability issue, but it should be addressed. The sponsor did mention that they were going to include some language on the plan review being designed to the Oregon Plumbing Specialty Code, which was an issue we had, and we need to assure that obviously they are using the current plumbing code in the state when they do their plans and their plan reviews. But we're, again, I guess we fall back to one of the basic principles and a priority of the Building Codes Division and the Department, and a lot of the jurisdictions of the last few years has been trying to focus on uniformity and consistency when it comes to code and code interpretations, and this bill doesn't go that direction. It actually frustrates that, in that you'll have engineers developing their own or using their own interpretations of codes. And there is a problem, and you've heard it from some of the contractors, that code interpretations are not the kind of science we'd like them to be, and we do have inconsistencies out there. We have worked with the state to develop some means to address those. We have an appeals process now, which we try to encourage contractors to use to request a review of a code call, whether it's in the plan review process or in the inspection process. They have timelines so that they can move quickly to do that review, because every day is dollars to the contractor. We're cognizant of that. Building officials and building departments, through their training, are trying to work on the consistency issues. Oftentimes, though, some of these problems occur because a plan was approved, but they've done some changes in the field. As you actually get out there in construction, you all of a sudden make some modifications. Those can be approved, but a lot of times they weren't in the original plan. And we get into some problems with, you know, the inspectors and the plan reviewers at that point. So we've got some work to do in as code administrators, but we also have means to address some of these issues. We have a sanctions process now. And if there's an inspector who routinely, more than an isolated case, but there's a pattern of an inspector who's making his or her own calls, well, then there's a process to sanction them. And ultimately, they can lose their certification. We need the help of contractors to identify those situations, and we know there's some, they're reluctant in many cases to report these because they're worried about, they're intimidated, and they don't want their next project to be, held up. And we understand that, but we've got to get better communications about which inspectors are creating these problems so that we can either work with them or help them find a new career, because it is a problem. And when you're talking you know, a week delay or whatever, that's a lot of money for the owners and the contractors. So we're willing to try and work with the industry on some better means of taking the plans and working with them out in the field when it comes to the inspections. But as I say, we're opposed to the concept of actually eliminating somebody, a third party, somebody that doesn't have a financial interest in that project. We believe somebody has to, should be out there looking at the, inspecting the projects. And David Berenberg has some mayors in town, so he wasn't able to participate in this, but he asked me also to put the League of Oregon Cities on record in opposition to the bill as drafted.
Thank you. Libby?
Yes, Libby Henry, representing the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and I've also brought a letter from the City of Eugene. First of all, I'll speak to our concerns. If this bill passed, it would significantly increase our role and our resource requirements and our cross-connection program and lead to greater numbers of conflicts with developers and contractors. EWEB now exercises a similar authority, the application of the plumbing code requirements for backflow prevention and new construction. We rely in part on plan reviews and enforcement actions of the City of Eugene and Lane County building departments, and we coordinate with their activities to minimize redundancy and to ensure the protection of the public water supply. Passage of this bill would likely lead to conflicts where we deviate from the stamp plans. Especially complex structure plans are often prepared by firms from out of state and are routinely corrected in the plan review process. Furthermore, contractors doing the installation often make changes in the construction process, and that even a correct set of plans does not always ensure an installation in compliance with the code. And from the City of Eugene, their IGA committee is going to be taking a position on this tomorrow. So what they've given me to give to you today is just simply a letter of concern, and I'll read a short piece into the record for them. Such legislation effectively preempts the City of Eugene's authority to review and enforce state and local plumbing code and complex structures. This bill may, in fact, limit our plumbing inspection and review process to the extent that, in some cases, an inspector must accept a non-compliant installation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I take one more moment? I forgot to mention that there are, in addition to the code, the plan review process triggers other requirements such as grease traps, cross connections, as Libby just mentioned, other aspects that are reviewed at that time. They're not part of the code. They're part of other city and county requirements, health requirements, and that's where they're picked up. I mean, whether they're in compliance or not. And there again, that piece will be omitted. I mean, won't be addressed if we don't have that plan reviewed by jurisdiction.
Did you have, Libby, is that your testimony, Olive?
That's good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3092. Representative Schaffler.
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules and to allow, I believe, just Representative Kitts to vote on House Bill 3273.
3273. Representative Schaffler moves we suspend the rules to allow Representative Kitts to vote on House Bill 3273. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Kitts, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Kitts votes aye on House Bill 3273. And we've got about 10 minutes at the most, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3094. Janet, very quickly, please, and JL, and John Hagee, and Kurt Schieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3094 would allow an employer consent of the applicant and in compliance with federal non-discrimination regulations to fill a plumbing apprenticeship from a pool of the employer's current employees, regardless of local joint committee apprenticeship selection policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. JL?
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, again, JL Wilson representing the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. 3094 is basically a workforce issue for small plumbing contractors, and it's meant to help address the problem of small contractors being able to find qualified apprentices and find qualified employees. 3094 simply attaches Oregon's apprenticeship statute to federal code. And that is what is already federal law, and it's an attachment on the testimony. And federal law, which is 29 CFR 30.5B3. Now, what this federal code does is it says if you, as an employer, have a written affirmative action plan to elevate women and minorities to position of apprenticeship, you can have you can choose one of four options which to choose apprentices. And option number three is selecting from a pool of current employees. And we think that this is beneficial for a couple of reasons, as I outline in the written testimony. First, because it would allow a small family operation, that is a father-son operation, to elevate the son to a position of apprenticeship. Second, you deal with an employer investing their own time and resources in finding employees that they've invested in, who they care about, and who they are comfortable in their own business to elevate them to a position of apprenticeship. It's an issue of management for a small employer. And finally, because the bill is attached to affirmative action requirements, it does have the benefit of promoting women and minorities and equal opportunity for those positions of apprenticeship. For those reasons, the Oregon PHCC supports House Bill 3094.
Thank you, Jill. John.
Chair Brown, committee members, for the record, again, my name is John Egge, president of a medium-sized plumbing firm in the metro area. I also have some significant experience as a former member of the Oregon State Training Council and a chair of a local joint committee and currently the chair of the Plumbers Training Trust for the Portland metro area. The problem is that in a previous legislative session, we created the language together with the division that you have before you without the amendments that comprise 3094. We thought that this would solve our problem, but it hasn't really solved our problem. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that the words that are on this paper actually do the solution to the problem, but this problem continues to exist, and that is this, that we have ephemeral kind of ability to promote our existing employees to positions of apprenticeship. Now, when I say ephemeral, it means that the council can take it away or give it back or take it away or give it back. And recently, the Portland area plumbers almost had their ability to promote their existing employees taken away based upon the fact that we didn't have enough women. Now, when I say enough women, it would be enough women based upon what the state staff said we ought to have in the program, not a goal that we had set ourselves. And you're talking about on the women's side, which is really the sticking point, the minority side, we're actually doing much better than any other selection method. You're talking about the difference between zero or one or two apprentices. I mean, it's probably no surprise to you that it's very difficult to get women to go into the plumbing trade. It's just not likely to happen on a 50-50 basis, which is roughly the equivalent of women to men in our society. So we do a lot of things to try to get as women to apply to the program. Sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not. But when we're not, we're punished and unable to promote our existing employees. And so the issue is we're trying to get to a point where we have some certainty in this industry with the ability to promote our regular full-time employees to positions of apprenticeship. Now, I will add that Mr. Sims from Boley, Director of Apprenticeship, and I have been talking about this, and there may be some way to get to a little more certainty. And I wouldn't propose what that is right now, but I would suggest that we might be able to get there. And with that, I would stand for any questions or turn it over to Kurt.
Kurt, why don't you...
For the record, I'm Kurt Cheever with Roto-Rooter Service and Plumbing. I'm also the second vice president for the PHEC, Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Contractors of Oregon. And for our membership, especially the small companies and the service-oriented companies and the family companies, in recent years, through this method, it's become a lot of now three-generational family plumbing companies can't get their next family member into the apprenticeship program to become a licensed journeyman to continue their company. And we think that there are some provisions that they're trying to do, but we think that's wrong. As John previously spoke, we both deal a lot in service-oriented work, which needs tremendous soft skills. And one way we learn our personnel is from running them from within our company. We gain time with them as their employer. We understand that they're going to be concerned about our customers and our mission statements. And we want to be able to promote those individuals to allow them to attend an apprenticeship program, which is a very fine program, and get them through that so we can improve our business. And it's a big issue with virtually all of our members. And we want to do whatever we can do to resolve it.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Could I have Stephen Sims, please? I hate to do this to you, Stephen, but you've got about 3 minutes on the outside.
Very quick. Thank you, Chair Brown and committee members. For the record, Stephen Sims, the administrator of the State Apprenticeship and Training Division, on behalf of Commissioner Dan Gardner. In past sessions, the Apprenticeship and Training Division and the State Council have been directed to try to get our programs to increase the number of women and minorities in our programs. Our numbers are not what we'd like to see. We feel that House Bill 3094 creates a barrier to keeping the trades open to women and men. Prior to 1998, most apprenticeship committees could select their apprentices. Their employers could select their apprentices however they saw fit. They had whoever they wanted sign an intent to hire form. They walked to the committee, and they got in. And guess what? The numbers of women and minorities did not reflect the numbers in the general population. That had been there for years. In response to that, in 1998, the council and the division decided to follow the federal rules on the selection of apprentices to the letter, meaning fair and objective selection criteria so that people got into programs based upon their merit. The argument that a family member cannot get in, I believe, is specious. If that family member merits rising to the top of the list, they will walk right into through the front door. Since we began using structured selection methods, not only have we increased diversity, and certainly with respect to women, nowhere near where we need to be, but we have increased diversity, but also our graduation rates for apprentices have increased overall from about 35% to about 52%. So we feel we're getting better applicants and programs. Finally, the reliance on federal regulation 30.5B3 is misplaced. That selection method where you have an internal affirmative action plan in your company and you put people in apprenticeship based on seniority, the commentary to the federal rule states that that clearly applies to large industrial manufacturers, i.e. you come into to a Chevy plant at a low level, you work there for a few years, and you get promoted. It does not apply to the construction industry. As Mr. Egge said earlier, if the real issue is how we evaluate whether or not programs are meeting their goals and timetables, I think we can do a better job of explaining that and fine-lining what the requirements are. But the Bureau and the State Apprenticeship Council opposes House Bill 3094, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
One great question.
Thank you. Mr. Sims, how many family members have been denied access to apprenticeship programs? Family members of an owner who own a company in the state of Oregon?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, we don't keep statistics, but usually when that happens, it comes to me eventually as by way of complaint. I think in the last 2 years, I have heard of three instances where someone called and said their family member was being denied entry into the apprenticeship program. In each case upon investigation, no, the individual simply did not rank high on their objective standards. In two of those cases, I know for a fact they eventually rose high enough on the list where they got into the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate it. Close the hearing on House Bill 3094, and we are adjourned.